Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. For more than a quarter century, Mike Collins has been one of the most prominent radio voices in the South. He recently celebrated 25 years as a host of Charlotte Talks, the daily news program on WFAE, the NPR station that also brings you this podcast. For Charlotte Talk's anniversary episode, which we've adapted here for Southbound, we flipped things around and put Mike in the guest chair. I asked him the questions about his early life in radio, his influences, his most memorable guests, and what it means to have the platform he's had in this city and this region. I think we made him uncomfortable once or twice. That's a good thing. Here's our conversation. How you feeling over there?
Very scared. I don't like being over here, Tommy.
So if you are normally hosting the show and you run into a guest who seems nervous or scared, what do you say to him? Anything?
I try to, before we start, lighten the situation, but then I lean in and look deeply into their eyes. I swear to God, that's true. And just become one with them. And usually loosen them up over time.
I'm trying. We're trying to become one right now. Maybe we'll be like one and a half when we're done. So I want to start by just kind of going through the logistics of this show. So when you're normally in this host chair and there's somebody going to be on the air the next day, how do you prepare?
Oh, my gosh. I read voluminous amounts of material. The producers who – we have a producer in charge of each show. Every day there's a different producer in charge of that show, and they have the arduous task of – searching out everything they can find about the guest or the guests or the topic or all three. And then they give me a packet of information, which is now electronic. There's nothing on paper anymore with links to everything. And I just read voluminous amounts about those people. And as I read, I jot down questions that I think that ought to be asked and try to put the show in some sort of an order so that I can guide both the guests, make the best use of the guest's time, and make sure that the listener gets the most out of it that I think they can get out of it. Sometimes I'm wrong. And then I let the show, when I'm doing the show, I let the show go where it wants to go. I mean, I have this roadmap, but if I can't know everything, and the guest usually has more interesting things to say than I could have anticipated. And so I let it go where I think it ought to go, and then bring it back to where I'd like it to go if we run out of steam over there.
Is that a skill you sort of always had to kind of be able to guide that, or do you feel like that's been honed over?
It's been honed, definitely. And the key is to listen. And I remember being a very young person. I think I was 24 years old, and I was working at a station in Washington, which was an adult, middle-of-the-road radio station with high-profile personality. It was the number one station in Washington, and I had no business being there at that age, but I was there. And Andy Williams came into the radio station one afternoon and just walked into the studio and sat down with the afternoon host, Bill Trumbull, and they talked for an hour. And when Andy Williams left, I walked in and I said, "How did you do that?" He said, "Well, hey, I've met him before. I see him on television. We play his music. And I listened." You just listen.
Do you have a routine when you're prepping? Like, do you have a favorite chair and you sit down and you get a glass of tea or whatever? Is there some particular way that, have you built habits around that sort of thing?
Here's what I do. You really want to know?
Absolutely. That's the whole point of the show, Mike. Okay. We really want to know.
Well, I look at the packet for today, for tomorrow's show, but I'm also getting an email about what's going to be on the following day. So my routine generally is to write the promo for that show and the opening minute of that show and get that done, and it's done. Because when I'm done with the actual show for tomorrow, I want to be done. I don't want to, because it takes hours. And then I sit down and start reading, and I write the reopen, which introduces the guests, and then I sit down and start writing all the questions. And I literally write the questions out. I don't read them. I don't use them the way they're written, but they're there. So in case I go blank or in case I have an aneurysm or something, I can look down and actually read the question. And then I order them. What order should these questions be in? And then I sit down and actually put bullet points in headlines, essentially, in between the sections. So in case the guest jumps from section 1 to section 95, I can go, oh, there it is. I can ask a question about that. Because I can't, I do a different topic and different guests every day, and I can't retain it. I just can't. So I have I do a roadmap every day for it.
So I've been a guest on your show a few times, mm-hmm. and the one thing I remember being consistent about those shows is that you showed up in the studio at what I felt like was the last possible second. It reminded me of that scene in Broadcast News when they're like sliding under the file cabinets and all. Is that deliberate?
Well, yes. Particularly when there are guests in the room, because I don't want to talk about the show with the guest prior to the show. I mean, I'll ask answer some very rudimentary questions to make them at ease. But I have found, and I found this out really early on in doing this show, that if you come in early and you talk, you do the show with the guest before the show goes on the air, they have nothing to say when it's because they've already done it. So I don't want to be in the room with them. It's not after the show's over. I'll sit there for an hour with them. But I don't want to do the show before we do the show. And I remember years ago when I was on television on Channel 3 and I did a show with Barbara McKay called Top of the Day. And there were times when I would literally walk into the studio while the opening theme music was playing, sit in the chair and put the mic on and go, good morning, literally, just like that. And Barbara would say, why do you do that? It scares me. I don't know. It's just the way I do it.
So I want to go back to that, as much as you can remember about those early days of the show in 1998. Who were you back then, and what were your sort of dreams or visions, if that's the right word, for what this show would be?
I was a very different person, and in terms of being a radio performer, a very different radio performer. I had done public television in the past, so I knew that this was not commercial radio. But I had just come off of 13 years on another radio station in this town and 10 years on television here. And I wanted this show to be, let's back up. It took me about a year to pitch this show and get the station to sign off on it because they were just transitioning into talk at the time from jazz. And when you do a talk show, that's a commitment. And it's a monetary commitment, and it is a commitment you have to trust the people behind the scenes and the people on the air because you're liable for what goes on your radio station. And they'd never done it here. But we were going to all this NPR talk, and it made sense to have it. And I wanted this to be the place that people turned when anything in Charlotte of importance happened, whether it's news, whether it's politics, whether it's arts, whether it's culture, whether it's silly stuff, whether it's serious stuff, we would be talking about it on this program. And it took a long time to make that happen because, A, nobody knew who the heck we were. Nobody really had heard of WFAE. And government officials and people coming through town who were luminaries, who are you? What do you do? What's this? What is this about? I don't know. NPR helped because that gave us cachet. And over time, we built up a reputation of being a place where you could come for an honest conversation, where we were not going to take you to the woodshed because of a political point of view, where we would ask serious questions and we would hold your feet to the fire, but we were going to be fair and you were going to have your chance to say what you wanted to say unedited. And I think that's what transpired over 25 years. But it took about, I don't know, Wendy could probably tell you better than I, it took about 5-6 years for us to make it easier for us to actually get people to come and be on the show.
Do you remember any sort of tipping point or anything where you feel like, oh, okay, now, you know, not that you've got it exactly like you want it, but like, okay, now I feel like this is kind of what we meant for this to be.
Yeah, about 10 years into it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And was there some particular show that did that or just like a vibe?
There might have been, but I have no memory, Tommy, as Wendy Herkey will tell you. But I just remember thinking, okay, because, you know, in any profession, I think they say you have to have what? How many hours? Like 10,000 hours?
That's
or
whatever,
to be good at it. And even though I'd been on the radio since 1972, this was a different animal. And we were making it up as we went along, like all the great I'm not a great pioneer, but all the great pioneers in this business made it up and found out what worked and discarded what didn't. And I remember sitting down at this microphone where you're sitting right now, the very first day of this show, and approaching it in a completely different way than I do it today, and thinking as I did it, this is wrong. This is not going to work.
What were you doing?
I was ad-libbing it. I didn't write anything out. I didn't write any of the questions. I didn't write any of the opens. I just said, good morning, welcome, this is a brand new program, here's what we're going to do. And it just didn't sound, it didn't feel like NPR. And I thought, and I listened to the show after we did it, after it was over, and it was live. And I thought, yep, this has got to change tomorrow, because it wasn't like NPR. It was too commercial.
And was that based on your history?
Yeah.
I want to kind of peel back even further now, if I can. Can you pinpoint a moment in your life when you thought, this is what I want to do for a living?
I was five.
I guess you can.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Do you remember Arthur Godfrey?
Vaguely.
Okay. I'm so old. Arthur Godfrey used to be on radio and television on CBS at the same time. And so he would wear headphones for the radio side of it and be on, and he would carry around a microphone because he would walk around the studio and do it. So when I was five, I got out a vacuum cleaner cord, electric power cord, and a pair of earmuffs, and I would walk around the house and pretend I was Arthur Godfrey. And then later on in life, I would record radio stations and clip out the jingles and clip out the commercials and sit in my bedroom and be on the radio and play these things on my little teeny tape recorder. I would insert these commercials and the jingles and the records into the mix here. And I just knew that's what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to be a musician because I took very expensive accordion lessons for a long time and paid my way through college playing the accordion.
I feel like everybody who plays the accordion has at some point in their life been asked, why the accordion?
Yeah, because some guy came door to door.
Really?
Yes. My father played trumpet, my mother played piano, and she sang when she was a young girl in like high school and college. And this guy came door to door, this is back in the 50s, selling accordion lessons. And he strapped it on me. And I put it on upside down, and I knew instantly it was on upside down, so I turned it around. And I knew that because we all watched Lawrence Welk. And I played a couple of notes, and I couldn't play anything at all. I was like seven. And he said, your son has talent. He's the music man. He's selling accordions and accordion lessons. And my father was a musician, so he said, did you like that? Okay, if you practice, I will pay to have you get lessons. And so I did, and I became, I mean, really good at it. And I, in the summertime, I'm very focused. I think I'm probably on the spectrum, quite honestly, but I'm very focused, and I would practice 8 hours a day in the summer when I got to be good. And that's why I got to be good, because I really, really, and my father paid, after I got really good at this, he put out $2,000 for an instrument. That was a lot of money back then, a lot of money.
I can't believe that in 25 years, Charlotte Talks has never had an accordion theme song.
We actually do.
We do.
Yeah, I recorded one once.
Really? Okay, let's hear that.
Oh, gosh.
We got about a minute. Let's hear that. So, Mike, you have what I think of as sort of the quintessential radio voice. And I'm wondering, is that a voice that you feel like you've kind of always had?
No.
Or did you craft it?
I didn't do anything. I wish I had. The very first time I was on the radio, it was on my college radio station on a Saturday morning doing a newscast. And when I used to have the tape, and we had an office fire where I put on my tapes and the tapes got destroyed. But if you listened to that tape, you would wonder, what is he thinking? Why does he think he has a future in this business?
I mean, it sounded like this. WMUC News, I'm Mike Collins.
I'm not exaggerating. That's what it sounded like. And you would wonder, why? Why would you think you have a future in this business? So it just kind of happened over the years. It just changed, and you learn. I mean, you learn what you hear yourself on tape, and you go, you hate yourself. I still hate myself on tape. I put myself to sleep when I listen to my voice on tape, and I just don't like anything that I do. But you do understand what works and what doesn't work, and you change over time because of that.
We got a little sidetracked with the accordion stuff in that last segment.
Good.
talking about your beginnings as a broadcaster, and you said you thought about it when you were five and that sort of thing. Was that something that sustained you all the way? I mean, was there, besides possibly a musician's life, was there ever any other path for you?
Maybe acting, maybe theater, but I like to eat on a regular basis, and that's hard to do when you're an itinerant actor, but I was always attracted to it. I think it's because my parents my mother was a housewife, and she had the radio on all day, and I heard all these people on the radio all day, every day. And we were among the first people in the neighborhood to have a TV, a little 13-inch black and white TV. And so people would come over at night and watch television with us because they didn't have one. And I thought, this is important. People are listening all the time, and they come over to the house and they watch this box. This must be important. I think I'd like to do that.
Was there anybody in particular that you modeled yourself after? I mean, you mentioned Arthur Godfrey before.
People that maybe people in this area wouldn't know, but my mentor was a man named Tom Gager, who was on WMAL in Washington in the 70s and 80s, and the late 60s too, I think. And when I was in college, I was assigned to write a paper. I was taking a broadcast management class, and we were assigned to write papers on a radio station. And I just happened to pull WMAL out of a hat. And it's the station I wanted to work at. And so I went over and I talked to him. We had to get interviews. So I went over and talked to him about his job. I talked to the program director about his job. I did a profile of the radio station, and then I turned it into a documentary. I didn't turn it in as a paper. I turned it in on tape. And in the course of that, Tom and I struck up a friendship, and he listened to me on another station in Washington. And about 9 months later, he called me and said, "We're looking for a young guy to do weekends. And I've been listening to you, and I think you should apply." And I said, "No, I can't do that. I'm not ready for that." He said, "Do a tape today and send it to Lynn McIntosh, the program director." And I did, and Lynn called me, and he said, "I'd like you to come in for an interview." So I was just flabbergasted, because when I made the tape, they told me to make it using their call letters. Don't make it, do an actual audition tape. And every time I would say their call letters, I would break up laughing, because of the ludicrous nature of my working there at my age. And so I went in for this interview, and it wasn't an interview. He said, "Here's the music library. Here's the stack of commercials. Here's the stack of jingles. Here's an engineer. Go in that studio with this engineer and do an hour. And don't do any edits. Start to finish, 1 hour." And I did, and halfway through it, it was not going well. And Frank Munzer was the engineer, and he said, "Let's stop." I said, "We can't stop." He's in my talkback in the headphones. I said, "We can't stop. It has to be unedited." He said, No. "We're starting all over again from the top. They'll never know." And we did, and I got the job.
And here you go.
And he saved my life. But Tom Gager is the guy that was you asked the question who I patterned myself. But there were a lot of good people in DC radio at the time, but he was the one.
Do you remember the first time somebody recognized you out in the world by your voice?
Yes, it was very disconcerting. It was at a Belk in Columbia, South Carolina. I was buying a watch. And she said, "You're that guy on the radio." I said, "Yeah." I was on WIS. And she said, "Yeah, I listen to you every day." And I thought, oh my God, this is really weird. And it got worse when I was on television. I never got into this business. It never occurred to me that people would know who you are, or that you would have, and I don't know why, because they had a role in my life, but that you would have a role to play in their lives. And at first, it was very disconcerting, but then I realized this is an enormous responsibility, because what you say matters.
When we come back, Mike Collins talks about how he learned how to become more himself on the radio.
For the longest time in commercial radio, the Mike Collins on the radio was not Mike Collins. He was a character.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Mike Collins. So I want to go back. You mentioned something about actor being a possibility as you were thinking about these things. And I know you've done a lot of theater here. You do Charlotte Squawks, which is sort of the, for those who don't know, the sort of the Funhouse Mirror version of Charlotte Talks on stage. What about acting, writing for the theater, that sort of thing? What about that has translated into the day job?
That's interesting. I think you have to help the listener through the program. You have to help them understand what's important, what should deserve stress, what's a throwaway. And you do that on radio only with your voice. On television, at least you have your face. But on radio, you only have your voice. And so I think that comes from learning how to deliver a line and create a character. I don't think, for the longest time in commercial radio, the Mike Collins on the radio was not Mike Collins. He was a character that I played because he had to be, not necessarily bigger than life, but he had to be something other than me because I'm pretty darn boring, Tommy, in real life. I'm just perfectly content to be by myself and sit. but you have to bring energy to it, and I think the acting training and just learning how to create a character and develop and read a line so that people can understand it and get the information that they need to get out of it for the story to progress. I use that every day. I don't think about it, but I use it every day.
Yeah, I was wondering whether you feel like what you do every day is some form of a performance.
Yes. Yes, and I've been a performer my entire life. I mean, I started performing when I was 8 years old, first playing the accordion and then doing other things and being on the Tony Grant Stars of Tomorrow show on the Steel Pier in Atlantic City every summer with other kids.
And you were saying that in earlier parts of your career, the person who was on the air was not you, or a very different version.
Well, it was a different version, a bigger version.
So how close is the real you to what we're hearing now?
I think a lot closer.
How so?
It's just that it's real. I'm not entertaining people. I'm informing people, and I'm not putting on airs or making things bigger so you'll listen like I used to do in commercial radio with big energy, you know? It's a conversation that we're having, like we're having right now. So there's very little artifice. It is what it is.
Do you have a listener in your head or in your mind as you're talking?
Not per se, but I know I'm talking to one person. And I learned that very early on. That's why in radio you don't often hear people say, well, good afternoon, everyone. No, it's good afternoon. You're talking to one human being. That's it. And I never think about people. It always fascinates me that people are actually listening. It never occurs to me. But I am talking to one person and the guest.
25 years of shows. The first question that came to mind for me was, have you had any that just, from the moment the show started, it was just out of your control, like a runaway horse? Like that you just never could get the reins back on it?
Well, Richard Simmons comes to mind.
Okay.
you know, You know you got to change the theme when the guests are dancing and they're not dancing in a complimentary way. For 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks.
I'm Mike.
I beg your pardon? What?
That was the cutest little song.
Well, bring it up. Let's hear more of it.
This it was a combination of Sesame Street. It's a cute song. You just want to pinch somebody's cheek after that song and say, that's a cute one.
How do I start this now? I don't know how to start this now. That's Richard Simmons. That's probably all I need to say. You know, diets are like...
Him and several other people. And, you know, at first, early on in my career, not necessarily here, when that would happen, and it usually happens with comedians, I felt, let's face it, Tommy, when you're doing this, you're in control. I mean, the guests know that, and that's why the guests are nervous, because they don't know what's coming at them yet. But you are. This is my house. Welcome. But I'm in control. But we have certain kinds of guests like that, like Richard Simmons. They're just a runaway train. And so you just have to learn to let go. Let them do their thing. They're there. They're the star, not you. So let them do their thing and get in there when you can and when you need to. But let them do it. So that's hard to do. It's hard to learn.
I know from the very beginning, you've done, many of your shows, if not most, have been about public affairs, local government, that sort of thing. You have outlasted mayors and school superintendents and all other types of public officials. Are there issues in Charlotte, in this area, that particularly frustrate you because over 25 years, there doesn't seem to have been much progress?
All of them. Well, you know, we're not a big city. We're not New York, and we're not Washington, and we're not even Atlanta. We're a big, small town, and although we're growing by leaps and bounds, that's what we are. And so we're faced with sometimes the same issues over and over and over, but different permutations and a different cast of characters. And this is not meant to be pejorative in any way. It's just that's just the way it is. So it frustrates me. And the producers will be the first to tell you, when we bring up a topic that we've done before, I say, why are we doing it again? And if we're not adding anything new to the story, but it's still a topic that deserves to be heard, why don't we just play the tape? So, and they have to then explain to me, like a first grader, here's why we're doing it, and here's what we can bring new to the story. And they always win, by the way. I can think of one instance where I think we didn't, the way they didn't win. But I have to be convinced. So, I mean, we've been talking about building the transit system out forever. Are we ever going to do it? I don't know. They seem to be taking their good, sweet time about asking for money. But that's just my perspective. It may not be accurate. There may be all kinds of people on the hamster wheel right now going crazy. But I can't think of another. There must be another issue. I just can't think of one.
How about things where you feel like the city has progressed a lot since you started?
Well, I remember in going to Springfest in 1985, after I just moved here, and that was the big annual event on the streets downtown on Trade and Tryon. And looking up and down the street, and after having lived in Columbia, thinking, I'm in the big city. We are, that was nothing compared to what we are now. And a lot of that was hurt by the pandemic, because just prior to the pandemic, Uptown Charlotte, oh my gosh, was a happening place, almost 24/7. It was, and I kept thinking when that was happening, just before the pandemic, gosh, I wish I were 21 again. I would own this town. This would be my little bailiwick. I would be out every night. And now I'm too old to enjoy all that and wouldn't want to do it. But I thought, darn, why wasn't this happening when I was 21? And now pretty much we're in a rebuilding phase, I think, from that, because it's not what it was. It's not returned yet.
How's the pandemic affected what you do? I know that most of the time, like you and I today, are in the studio talking face-to-face, right. But that's not the norm anymore, right?
Nope. I haven't been in the studio in 2.5 years. I do the show from home, and we did it from home. We were in Spirit Square one day doing the show, and the next day, and we were talking about this thing called coronavirus, COVID something, 18, 19, whatever it was. That was one day, and the next day, we were all at home doing it. And how we did it Well, first of all, we couldn't have done it 10 years ago. We couldn't have done it 5 years ago, I don't think. The technology just happened to coincide with our ability, with the need. And we did it kind of seamlessly, and it was amazing how seamless it was. But it's created a monster, because we used to be able to get guests to come into the studio. We used to be able to get guests who were in, like, California to go to NPR West, or people in New York to go to a studio in Manhattan. So they would sound like they were in my studio, even though they were thousands of miles away. They won't do that anymore. It's all on Zoom. And most guests will only come on Zoom. So, I'm at home. I'm on a high capacity hookup with a real microphone, and they're talking into their laptops.
So we talked at the very beginning about that, you know, becoming one with a guest, looking them in the eye.
It's harder.
Yeah. How do you try to make that connection now?
Talk to them before the show, but not about the show. But it really is hard, because I can't look in their eyes, because quite often they're not looking at me, or their camera is one place, but their monitor is another place, so they're not really seeing you. It's been very difficult. It's not as intimate. That's what I like about radio. I love television, but I like radio because it's intimate. It is one-on-one, and you're having a conversation to somebody, and it's just in this new paradigm, it's just more difficult. It works, but it's not as nice.
COVID aside and Zoom aside, how has the day-to-day of this job changed over the 25 years you've been doing it?
We have more producers. They're better at their jobs. Not because the old producers were not good. It's just that they didn't have the tools and the resources that we have now. I remember that when we first started the show, my producer was a part-timer, and he worked all night at a food service company. The show was on at 9 o'clock in the morning, but I couldn't start working on it some days until 10, because that's when he got up. So he would put together this packet, and I would read through the packet and think, okay, I think I know what this is about, but I'm not sure. And I'd call him and find out it wasn't about that at all. So at 10 o'clock, I'd start working on the show, 10 p.m., for the next day. So it's easier now.
It's easier now.
Yeah.
Is there anything about it that's... you wish it was like it was in 1998?
Absolutely not.
There's no nostalgia for that era, though.
For the people.
When you start to think about moments on the shows you've done, what are some of the ones that you always think about or that come to mind? whether they were great successes or disasters or...
Well, I'll tell you three. You remember Bonnie Franklin?
One
day at a time. She was here to do a show for Charlotte Repertory Theater. And at the time, she was one of the bigger guests that we'd ever had on this show in terms of national prominence. You see that little button, that little yellow button in front of you? Maybe it's not there. Maybe they've changed the console. I haven't been here in 2 years, but it says dump on it. That's the delay button. So in case somebody says a naughty word, you push that button, and that naughty word never gets on the air. And we build back up to real to tape time. Well, she said a naughty word in the course of it. And I thought, did she just say that word? Really? I got to do something here, don't I? She said that word. Where's the button? Where's the button? And by the time I found the button, it was too late. So it went out on the air, and we had to edit it. But for, of all people to say something, it was not going to be Bonnie Franklin. But she did, the late Bonnie Franklin. Robert Goulet was in town to do Camelot. And he came in, and I was walking down the hall, and I heard him talking to his assistant, his publicist. All these people come in with their publicists, saying, I've only got 5 minutes for this. I'm only going to give him 5 minutes, and then we've got to go. What's our next appointment? I don't have to be on television at like 10:30 or 9:30 or something. I'm giving him 5 minutes. And I said, no, you're not. I walked in the door. I said, no, you're not. This is an hour. He said, I'm giving you 5 minutes. And I said, you know, we've spoken before. He had no recollection. I interviewed him for TV many years before that. But I said, no, you'll be here. Trust me. You'll be here for an hour. And I'm thinking, no, he won't. He's going to leave me in 5 minutes. And then what am I going to do? This is live. But I just was confident. And within 5 minutes, I had him singing live on the radio. I don't know how it happened, Tommy. I think it was that he realized that this little whippersnapper knew who he was, knew what his background was,
his history, his contributions to both music and to theater, and he trusted me all of a sudden. And he told me great stories about how Alan J. Lerner of Lerner and Lowe told him how to do some of the things in Camelot, and how to phrase I can't remember the song. Anyway, he told me how, and it was interesting to hear that story. And then there was, I can't remember the name of the basketball player.
Oh, Bill Russell.
Bill Russell. I can never remember his name because he traumatized me. I mean, he really did. He traumatized me. I walked into the studio. He's sitting here. We were going to do a pre-tape because he couldn't do it live. So we did it in the afternoon. And we had already promoted the fact. The promos were running on the air as I walked into the studio. Bill Russell, tomorrow, Charlotte Talks. And he was here to promote his book. And I walked into the studio, and he didn't get up, which is a good thing because he's 9 feet tall. That would really have intimidated me. I know nothing about basketball. Zero. Zilch. There could not be a human being on the planet who knows less about basketball than me. And I walked in, and I said, Mr. Russell, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. He said, I said, this is going to be a little bit of a different interview because it's not going to be about X's and O's. It's going to be about you. It's going to be about your relationship with basketball, your contributions to the sport, why you played it, blah, 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 and your book. So we start the show. I read the open. I welcome him. I ask him the first question, and it was not a yes or no answer. And I go, I don't know. I ask him another question. Nah, not really. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I've got an hour. This is going to last 10 minutes. The third question, same kind of response. And so I had read his book, and I said, you know, you're here to talk about your book, and we're going to talk about your book, but one of the things that I took from that book is that your mom told you how to be a gentleman. Would she be happy with you right now? I don't know where that came from, but he blossomed because I had read his book and because I was talking about his mother. And the rest of the interview was great. He gave me great answers. So I don't know. God was looking out for me, I guess. I don't know.
I'm kind of putting you on the spot here to ask a question like this, but can you remember a show or a moment where somebody said something or maybe they went into a little monologue or whatever and it just knocked you for a wallop and you weren't expecting it? Like maybe not a performer, not a professional, some just ordinary guest just said something that
and
really...
Yes, and I don't know that it was here. I can't remember where I did this interview.
That's okay.
It might have been at another radio station, but there was a guy, and he was a guest on 60 Minutes. He was an American who had spent a lot of time in communist China, and he was there because he was an expert in broadcasting. And at one point, under the Mao regime, they arrested his wife, and they arrested him, and they put him in jail at hard labor for years. And it was all because, I think, of something that Mao's wife didn't like about him. And one day they let him out, and they gave him the choice. You can stay here and go back to your job with teaching us how to do broadcasting in China. Or you can go home. Here's your money. We'll pay for your house, and you can go home. He chose to stay. They did it again later on. And that the next time he was given the opportunity to get out, he did leave. He came back to the United States. And I said, why? I mean, you're at hard labor for 10 years. Why would you stay? He said, because I really thought I could teach them how to be freer in broadcasting and how to let information go out and be less restrictive. I really thought I could have an impact. Wow. I just couldn't get over it.
I wonder if you feel like you're the format of this show itself is a bit of a boats against the current situation now because people's attention spans seem to be shorter.
Yeah.
They're looking at 30-second TikToks or whatever instead of an hour-long talk show. First of all, does that worry you? And second, Have you done anything differently to try to accommodate that?
Years ago, when we first started, we did a lot of long-form interviews, one-on-one with one guest, lots of authors, artists, things like that. And it was good for that era. And I remember a program director coming up to me and saying, this should be a podcast, because people don't have the attention span anymore. And these NPR driveway moments that we talk about do occur, but it annoys people because they want to hear the rest of the story, but they don't want to have to sit in their car and wait, because they got to go and do things. They have to live life. So long form is better suited on a podcast, because you can stop and pick it up where you left off. We need to do something that has more activity, that you can get in snippets. And at about the same time, we started focusing more on current events and the news. And yeah, you'd be well. It would be a good thing if you could hear the whole show, because we cover a lot of different topics, but we cover little sections. So if you go away, there's some connectivity, but the next segment may have nothing to do with the previous. So it's kind of self-contained for people who can't stick around longer. And that's just the reality. And I think it's become worse with podcasts and the pandemic, because podcasts decreased radio listening. You can't listen to two things at once. And the pandemic has changed everything, because people don't commute in their cars like they used to. So radio listening has changed because of that. Everything has changed. This business resembles nothing what it resembled when I got into it.
Not only that, it seems to be, you know, people have been angry at the media basically mm-hmm. since the Ten Commandments, you know. But I do wonder if you feel like over the period that you've done this show, whether that sort of thing has gotten worse in your mind, if you feel more beset in a ways that you didn't before. You know, we're just, as today as we're talking about this, I know we've just been talking about Elon Musk saying NPR is state-sanctioned media, and so NPR's gotten off of Twitter and all this sort of thing. And sometimes it does feel like we're pushing against the tide a little bit. And
yeah.
I wonder if you feel like that's a stronger feeling now than you used to
have. Well, we're all siloed. I mean, people who need to hear things are not here. And maybe we need to hear what's being said over there, but we're not there. We have chosen our side, and by God, we're sticking to it. And I remember early on when, because I never thought I would be doing this kind of a show ever in my life. I always thought of myself, I got into this business to have a good time and play Frank Sinatra. That's it. That's what I wanted to do. So the idea that I would be doing serious topics with serious people and having serious discussions about very complex issues, political and otherwise, is something I could never have predicted. But I take it really seriously, because there's a responsibility attached to this like nothing else that I can think of. But I remember early on, when I wasn't really terribly political and really had not formed a political point of view, every once in a while somebody in politics would say something that I thought, that's crazy, or I don't agree with that at all. But because I was on the radio, I could talk to them. I had a reason to have a really serious, long conversation with them. I loved those conversations. Those are the conversations I liked the most. Talking to people who I did not understand and perhaps really vehemently disagreed with, because I got a chance to see how they thought and why they thought what they thought. And that's what's missing today. People don't even know it, because they just won't open themselves up to the other side. But if they did, that's how you find common ground. That's how you come to a realization that, yeah, you may not agree with everything they say, but they have a reason behind it. And if their reasoning, if you understand their reasoning, you still may disagree, but it makes them more human. It doesn't make them the villain, the creature that needs to be stamped out. And that's what we're missing. And I don't know how we get back to that. I'm hoping that this business, where it's quite clear that Fox News, at least on several different topics, have been outwardly, unabashedly lying to their listeners. I'm hoping that that will have some impact, or open the door
for those people to seek out other sources of information and find out that not everything that they've been told is true. But that's me.
Radio has always been a business where people move around. They leave jobs, they get fired, they move along, that sort of thing. What does it mean for you to have thrived in the same spot for 25 years?
Wow. And I've been in this town since 85. And I used to come up here to do weekends on another station in 1983 for several years. Just before I came here, I had a decision to make. And that was whether I wanted to, I had just been let go at another station, and do I want to go and start all over again in a place where I don't know anything about anything and build from there? And I thought, no, if you can stay here, this is a nice place to live, and you know the territory, and you have institutional memory. So that's what it's meant to me, the fact that I could stay here and start this program and build this program over time and help make it become what I thought it could become. I didn't know for a fact, but I thought if we had this place where you could hear everything that people are talking about in Charlotte from a wide variety of points of view and a wide variety of topics, that it would be successful. I never thought I'd be doing this 25 years from the day we started. Never in a million years. But Tommy, I have always stayed too long at the fair.
I want to end the way that you often in your shows. I hear the news roundup every Friday, and you drop in some little question. You give people 10 seconds to answer it.
What's the story of your life?
I was going to say, Mike Collins, 10 seconds. What's the meaning of life?
Oh, my God, Tommy. To do something with it that's valuable, but do something that helps people and makes their lives better or more interesting or makes them laugh.
It's more than 10 seconds, but I think we'll take it. One of the things you learn early on in any kind of creative work is that no one does it alone. Mike Collins has a team of producers that work hard to get Charlotte Talks on the air and in your podcast feed every morning. Wendy Herkey, the executive producer, was in the next studio over as Mike and I had the conversation that you just heard. We could see her through the window. She gave us time cues and hit us with a thumbs up when we said something she liked. So in any audio show, just remember, there's a lot of people behind the voice. But when you listen, you probably don't think much about that. It's the magic of radio. One person talking directly to you. The voices that last over the years, the ones you remember, are the ones that people come to count on, to enjoy, to take comfort in. A beacon in the fog. Mike Collins has been that at WFAE for 25 years and in Charlotte for even longer. It's a tremendous gift to have the same trusted voice in your ear for such a long time. And as you heard Mike say, the gift goes in both directions. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where every episode as show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.